They were 70 miles and an hour away from it when she said, "Hank, do you see the Taggart Comet being pulled across the continent by a coal burner of that kind?" "What's the matter with you? Pull yourself together."
"I'm sorry. It's just that I keep thinking it won't be any use, all my new track and all your new furnaces, if we don't find someone able to produce diesel engines. If we don't find him fast."
"Ted Nielsen of Colorado is your man."
"Yes, if he finds a way to open his new plant. He's sunk more money than he should into the bonds of the John Galt line."
"That's turned out to be a pretty profitable investment, hasn't it?"
"Yes, but it's held him up. Now he's ready to go ahead, but he can't find the tools. There are no machine tools to buy, not anywhere, not at any price. He's getting nothing but promises and delays. He's combing the country, looking for old junk to reclaim from closed factories. If he doesn't start soon,
he will. Who's going to stop him now?"
"Hank," she said suddenly, "could we go to a place I'd like to see?"
"Sure. Anywhere. Which place?"
"It's in Wisconsin. There used to be a great motor company there in my father's time. We had a branch line serving it, but we closed the line about 7 years ago when they closed the factory. I think it's one of those blighted areas now. Maybe there's still some machinery left there that Ted Nielsen could use. It might have been overlooked. The place is forgotten, and there's no transportation to it at all."
"I'll find it. What was the name of the factory?"
"The 20th Century Motor Company."
"Oh, of course. That was one of the best motor firms in my youth, perhaps the best. I seem to remember that there was something odd about the way it went out of business.
Can't recall what it was."
It took them 3 days of inquiries, but they found the bleached, abandoned road, and now they were driving through the yellow leaves that glittered like a sea of gold coins to the 20th Century Motor Company.
"Hank, what if anything happens to Ted Nielsen?"
she asked suddenly as they drove in silence. "Why should anything happen to him?"
"I don't know, but... well, there was Dwight Sanders. He vanished. United Locomotives is done for now, and the other plants are in no condition to produce diesels. I've stopped listening to promises. And of what use is a railroad without motive power?"
"Of what use is anything, for that matter, without it?"
The leaves sparkled, swaying in the wind. They spread for miles, from grass to brush to trees, with the motion and all the colors of fire. They seemed to celebrate an accomplished purpose, burning in unchecked, untouched abundance.
Reardon smiled.
"There's something to be said for the wilderness. I'm beginning to like it.
New country that nobody's discovered."
She nodded gaily.
"It's good soil. Look at the way things grow. I'd clear that brush, and I'd build a..."
And then they stopped smiling. The corpse they saw in the weeds by the roadside was a rusty cylinder with bits of glass, the remnant of a gas station pump. It was the only thing left visible. The few charred posts, the slab of concrete, and the sparkle of glass dust, which had been a gas station, were swallowed in the brush, not to be noticed except by a careful glance, not to be seen at all in another year. They looked away. They drove on, not wanting to know what else lay hidden under the miles of weeds. They felt the same wonder, like a weight, in the silence between them. Wonder as to how much the weeds had swallowed, and how fast. The road ended abruptly behind the turn of a hill. What remained was a few chunks of concrete sticking out of a long pitted stretch of tar and mud. The concrete had been smashed by someone and carted away. Even weeds could not grow in the strip of earth left behind. On the crest of a distant hill, a single telegraph pole stood slanted against the sky like a cross over a vast grave. It took them 3 hours and a punctured tire to crawl in low gear through trackless soil, through gullies, then down ruts left by cartwheels, to reach the settlement that lay in the valley beyond the hill with the telegraph pole. A few houses still stood within the skeleton of what had once been an industrial town. Everything that could move had moved away, but some human beings had remained. The empty structures were vertical rubble. They had been eaten not by time, but by men. Boards torn out at random, missing patches of roofs, holes left in gutted cellars. It looked as if blind hands had seized whatever fitted the need of the moment, with no concept of remaining in existence the next morning. The inhabited houses were scattered at random among the ruins. The smoke of their chimneys was the only movement visible in town. A shell of concrete, which had been a schoolhouse, stood on the outskirts. It looked like a skull, with the empty sockets of glassless windows, with a few strands of hair still clinging to it in the shape of broken wires. Beyond the town, on a distant hill, stood the factory of the 20th Century Motor Company. Its walls, roof lines, and smokestacks looked trim, impregnable like a fortress. It would have seemed intact, but for a silver water tank. The water tank was tipped sidewise. They saw no trace of a road to the factory in the tangled miles of trees and hillsides. They drove to the door of the first house in sight that showed a feeble signal of rising smoke. The door was open. An old woman came shuffling out at the sound of the motor. She was bent and swollen, barefooted, dressed in a garment of flour sacking. She looked at the car without astonishment, without curiosity. It was the blank stare of a being who had lost the capacity to feel anything but exhaustion. "Can you tell me the way to the factory?" asked Reardon. The woman did not answer at once. She looked as if she would be unable to speak English.
"What factory?" she asked.
Reardon pointed. "That one?"
"It's closed."
"I know it's closed. But is there any way to get there?"
"I don't know."
"Is there any sort of road?"
"There's roads in the woods."
"Any for a car to drive through?"
"Maybe."
"Well, which would be the best road to take?"
"I don't know."
Through the open door, they could see the interior of her house. There was a useless gas stove, its oven stuffed with rags, serving as a chest of drawers. There was a stove built of stones in a corner, with a few logs burning under an old kettle, and long streaks of soot rising up the wall. A white object lay propped against the legs of a table. It was a porcelain washbowl torn from the wall of some bathroom, filled with wilted cabbages. A tallow candle stood in a bottle on the table. There was no paint left on the floor. Its boards were scrubbed to a soggy gray that looked like the visual expression of the pain in the bones of the person who had bent and scrubbed and lost the battle against the grime now soaked into the grain of the boards. A brood of ragged children had gathered at the door behind the woman, silently, one by one. They stared at the car, not with the bright curiosity of children, but with the tension of savages ready to vanish at the first sign of danger. "How many miles is it to the factory?" asked Reardon.
10 miles, said the woman, and added, "Maybe 5.
"How far is the next town?"
"There ain't any next town."
"There are other towns somewhere. I mean, how far?"
"Yeah, somewhere."
In the vacant space by the side of the house, they saw faded rags hanging on a clothesline, which was a piece of telegraph wire. 3 chickens pecked among the beds of a scraggly vegetable garden. A 4th sat roosting on a bar which was a length of plumber's pipe. 2 pigs waddled in a stretch of mud and refuse. The stepping stones laid across the muck were pieces of the highway's concrete. They heard a screeching sound in the distance and saw a man drawing water from a public well by means of a rope pulley. They watched him as he came slowly down the street. He carried 2 buckets that seemed too heavy for his thin arms. One could not tell his age. He approached and stopped, looking at the car. His eyes darted at the strangers, then away, suspicious and furtive. Reardon took out a $10 bill and extended it to him, asking, "Would you please tell us the way to the factory?" The man stared at the money with sullen indifference, not moving, not lifting a hand for it, still clutching the 2 buckets. If one were ever to see a man devoid of greed, thought Dagny, there he was.
"We don't need no money around here," he said.
"Don't you work for a living?"
"Yeah."
"Well, what do you use for money?" The man put the buckets down as if it had just occurred to him that he did not have to stand straining under their weight.
"We don't use no money," he said. "We just trade things amongst us."
"How do you trade with people from other towns?"
"We don't go to no other towns."
"You don't seem to have it easy here."
"What's that to you?"
"Nothing. Just curiosity." "Why do you people stay here?"
"My old man used to have a grocery store here. Only the factory closed."
"Why didn't you move?"
"Where to?"
"Anywhere."
"What for?"
Dagny was staring at the two buckets. They were square tins with rope handles. They had been oil cans.
Listen, said Reardon. Can you tell us whether there's a road to the factory?
There's plenty of roads.
Is there one that a car can take?
I guess so.
Which one?
The man weighed the problem earnestly for some moments.
Well, now, if you turn to the left by the schoolhouse, he said, and go on till you come to the Crooked Oak, there's a road up there. That's fine when it don't rain for a couple of weeks.
When did it rain last?
Yesterday.
Is there another road?
Well, you could go through Hanson's pasture and across the woods, and then there's a good solid road there all the way down to the creek.
Is there a bridge across the creek?
No.
What are the other roads?
Well, if it's a car road that you want, there's one the other side of Miller's Patch. It's paved. It's the best road for a car. You just turn to the right by the schoolhouse and...
But that road doesn't go to the factory, does it?
No, not to the factory.
All right, said Reardon. Guess we'll find our own way.
He had pressed the starter when a rock came smashing into the windshield. The glass was shatterproof, but a sunburst of crack spread across it. They saw a ragged little hoodlum vanishing behind a corner with a scream of laughter, and they heard the shrill laughter of children answering him from behind some windows or crevices.
Reardon suppressed a swear word.
The man looked vapidly across the street, frowning a little. The old woman looked on without reaction. She had stood there silently, watching without interest or purpose, like a chemical compound on a photographic plate, absorbing visual shapes because they were there to be absorbed, but unable ever to form any estimate of the objects of her vision. Dagny had been studying her for some minutes. The swollen shapelessness of the woman's body did not look like the product of age and neglect. It looked as if she was pregnant. This seemed impossible, but glancing closer, Dagny saw that her dust-colored hair was not gray, and that there were few wrinkles on her face. It was only the vacant eyes, the stooped shoulders, the shuffling movements that gave her the stamp of senility. Dagny leaned out and asked, "How old are you?" The woman looked at her not in resentment, but merely as one looks at a pointless question.
37,
she answered. They had driven 5 former blocks away when Dagny spoke. "Hank," she said in terror. "That woman is only 2 years older than I."
"Yes."
"God, how did they ever come to such a state?"
He shrugged. "Who is John Galt?"
The last thing they saw as they left the town was a billboard. A design was still visible on its peeling strips, imprinted in the dead gray that had once been color. It advertised a washing machine. In a distant field beyond the town, they saw the figure of a man moving slowly, contorted by the ugliness of a physical effort beyond the proper use of a human body. He was pushing a plow by hand. They reached the factory of the 20th Century Motor Company 2 miles and 2 hours later. They knew as they climbed the hill that their quest was useless. A rusted padlock hung on the door of the main entrance, but the huge windows were shattered, and the place was open to anyone. To the woodchucks, the rabbits, and the dried leaves that lay in drifts inside. The factory had been gutted long ago. The great pieces of machinery had been moved out by some civilized means. The neat holes in their bases still remained in the concrete of the floor. The rest had gone to random looters. There was nothing left except refuse, which the neediest tramp had found worthless. Piles of twisted, rusted scraps, of boards, plaster, and glass splinters, and the steel stairways, built to last and lasting, rising in trim spirals to the roof. They stopped in the great hall where a ray of light fell diagonally from a gap in the ceiling, and the echoes of their steps rang around them, dying far away in rows of empty rooms. A bird darted from among the steel rafters and went in a hissing streak of wings out into the sky. "We'd better look through it just in case," said Dagny. "You take the shops and I'll take the annexes. Let's do it as fast as possible."
"I don't like to let you wander around alone. I don't know how safe they are, any of those floors or stairways."
"Oh, nonsense. I can find my way around a factory or in a wrecking crew. Let's get it over with." I want to get out of here. When she walked through the silent yards, where steel bridges still hung overhead, tracing lines of geometrical perfection across the sky, her only wish was not to see any of it. But she forced herself to look. It was like having to perform an autopsy on the body of one's love. She moved her glance as an automatic searchlight, her teeth clamped tight together. She walked rapidly. There was no necessity to pause anywhere. It was in a room of what had been the laboratory that she stopped. It was a coil of wire that made her stop. The coil protruded from a pile of junk. She had never seen that particular arrangement of wires, yet it seemed familiar, as if it touched the hint of some memory, faint and very distant. She reached for the coil but could not move it. It seemed to be part of some object buried in the pile. The room looked as if it had been an experimental laboratory, if she was right in judging the purpose of the torn remnants she saw on the walls, a great many electrical outlets, bits of heavy cable, lead conduits, glass tubing, built-in cabinets without shelves or doors. There was a great deal of glass, rubber, plastic, and metal in the junk pile, and dark gray splinters of slate that had been a blackboard. Scraps of paper rustled dryly all over the floor. There were also remnants of things which had not been brought here by the owner of that room. Popcorn wrappers, a whiskey bottle, a confession magazine. She attempted to extricate the coil from the scrap pile. It would not move. It was part of some large object. She knelt and began to dig through the junk. She had cut her hands. She was covered with dust by the time she stood up to look at the object she had cleared. It was the broken remnant of the model of a motor. Most of its parts were missing, but enough was left to convey some idea of its former shape and purpose. She had never seen a motor of this kind, or anything resembling it. She could not understand the peculiar design of its parts, or the functions they were intended to perform. She examined the tarnished tubes and odd-shaped connections. She tried to guess their purpose, her mind going over every type of motor she knew, and every possible kind of work its parts could perform. None fitted the model. It looked like an electric motor, but she could not tell what fuel it was intended to burn. It was not designed for steam or oil or anything she could name. Her sudden gasp was not a sound but a jolt that threw her at the junk pile. She was on her hands and knees, crawling over the wreckage, seizing every piece of paper in sight, flinging it away, searching further. Her hands were shaking. She found part of what she hoped had remained in existence. It was a thin sheaf of typewritten pages clamped together, the remnant of a manuscript. Its beginning and end were gone. The bits of paper left under the clamp showed the thick number of pages it had once contained. The paper was yellowed and dry. The manuscript had been a description of the motor. From the empty enclosure of the plant's powerhouse, Reardon heard her voice screaming, "Hank!" It sounded like a scream of terror. He ran in the direction of the voice. He found her standing in the middle of a room, her hands bleeding, her stockings torn, her suit smeared with dust, a bunch of papers clutched in her hand. "Hank, what does this look like?" she asked, pointing at an odd piece of wreckage at her feet. Her voice had the intense, obsessed tone of a person stunned by a shock, cut off from reality. "What does it look like? Are you hurt? What happened?" "No." "Oh, never mind. Don't look at me. I'm all right. Look at this." "Do you know what that is?"
"What did you do to yourself?"
"I had to dig it out of there. I'm all right."
"You're shaking."
"You will, too, in a moment. Hank, look at it. Just look and tell me what you think it is."
He glanced down, then looked attentively. Then he was sitting on the floor, studying the object intently.
"It's a queer way to put a motor together," he said, frowning.
"Read this," she said, extending the pages.
He read, looked up, and said,
"Good God."
She was sitting on the floor beside him, and for a moment they could say nothing else.
"It was the coil," she said.
She felt as if her mind were racing. She could not keep up with all the things which a sudden blast had opened to her vision, and her words came hurtling against one another.
It was the coil that I noticed first, because I'd seen drawings like it, not quite, but something like it years ago when I was in school. It was in an old book. It was given up as impossible, long, long ago. But I liked to read everything I could about railroad motors. That book said that there was a time when men were thinking of it. They worked on it. They spent years on experiments, but they couldn't solve it, and they gave it up. It was forgotten for generations. I didn't think that any living scientist ever thought of it now, but someone did. Someone has solved it. Now, today. Hank, do you understand? Those men long ago tried to invent a motor that would draw static electricity from the atmosphere, convert it, and create its own power as it went along. They couldn't do it. They gave it up. She pointed at the broken shape. But there it is. He nodded. He was not smiling. He sat looking at the remnant, intent on some thought of his own. It did not seem to be a happy thought. Hank, don't you understand what this means? It's the greatest revolution in power motors since the internal combustion engine. Greater than that, it wipes everything out and makes everything possible. To hell with Dwight Sanders and all of them. Who'll want to look at a diesel? Who'll want to worry about oil, coal, or refueling stations? Do you see what I see? A brand new locomotive half the size of a single diesel unit, and with 10 times the power? A self-generator working on a few drops of fuel with no limits to its energy, the cleanest, swiftest, cheapest means of motion ever devised. Do you see what this will do to our transportation systems and to the country? In about 1 year? There was no spark of excitement in his face. He said slowly, "Who designed it? Why was it left here?"
"We'll find out."
He weighed the pages in his hand reflectively. "Dagny," he asked, "if you don't find the man who made it, will you be able to reconstruct that motor from what is left?" She took a long moment, then the word fell with a sinking sound.
"No.
Nobody will." He had it all right. It worked, judging by what he writes here. "It's the greatest thing I've ever laid eyes on." "It was. We can't make it work again. To supply what's missing would take a mind as great as his."
"I'll find him. If I have to drop every other thing I'm doing."
"And if he's still alive."
She heard the unstated guess in the tone of his voice. "Why do you say it like that?"
"I don't think he is. If he were, would he leave an invention of this kind to rot on a junk pile? Would he abandon an achievement of this size? If he were still alive, you would have had the locomotives with the self-generators years ago. And you wouldn't have had to look for him, because the whole world would know his name by now."
"I don't think this model was made so very long ago."
He looked at the paper of the manuscript and at the rusty tarnish of the motor. "About 10 years ago, I'd guess. Maybe a little longer."
"We've got to find him, or somebody who knew him. This is more important
than anything owned or manufactured by anyone today." "I don't think we'll find him. And if we don't, nobody will be able to repeat his performance. Nobody will rebuild his motor. There's not enough of it left. It's only a lead, an invaluable lead. But it would take the sort of mind that's born once in a century to complete it. Do you see our present-day motor designers attempting it?"
"No."
"There's not a first-rate designer left. There hasn't been a new idea in motors for years. That's one profession that seems to be dying, or dead."
"Hank, do you know what that motor would have meant if built?"
He chuckled briefly. "I'd say about 10 years added to the life of every person in this country, if you consider how many things it would have made easier and cheaper to produce. How many hours of human labor it would have released for other work, and how much more anyone's work would have brought him. Locomotives? What about automobiles and ships and airplanes with a motor of this kind? And tractors and power plants? All hooked to an unlimited supply of energy with no fuel to pay for except for a few pennies worth to keep the converter going. That motor could have set the whole country in motion and on fire. It would have brought an electric light bulb into every hole. Even into the homes of those people we saw down in the valley."
"It would have? It will. I'm going to find the man who made it."
"We'll try." He rose abruptly, but stopped to glance down at the broken remnant and said with a chuckle that was not gay, "There was the first motor for the John Galt line.
Then he spoke in the brusque manner of an executive. First, we'll try to see if we can find their personnel office here. We'll look for their records if there's any left. We want the names of their research staff and their engineers. I don't know who owns this place now, and I suspect that the owners will be hard to find, or they wouldn't have let it come to this. Then we'll go over every room in the laboratory. Later, we'll get a few engineers to fly here and comb the rest of the place. They started out, but she stopped for a moment on the threshold. Hank, that motor was the most valuable thing inside this factory, she said, her voice low. It was more valuable than the whole factory and everything it ever contained. Yet it was passed up and left in the refuse. It was the one thing nobody found worth the trouble of taking.
That's what frightens me about this, he answered.
The personnel office did not take them long. They found it by the sign which was left on the door, but it was the only thing left. There was no furniture inside, no papers, nothing but the splinters of smashed windows. They went back to the room of the motor. Crawling on hands and knees, they examined every scrap of the junk that littered the floor. There was little to find. They put aside the papers that seemed to contain laboratory notes, but none referred to the motor, and there were no pages of the manuscript among them. The popcorn wrappers and the whiskey bottle testified to the kind of invading hordes that had rolled through the room, like waves washing the remnants of destruction away to unknown bottoms. They put aside a few bits of metal that could have belonged to the motor, but these were too small to be of value. The motor looked as if parts of it had been ripped off, perhaps by someone who thought he could put them to some customary use. What had remained was too unfamiliar to interest anybody. On aching knees, her palms spread flat upon the gritty floor, she felt the anger trembling within her, the hurting, helpless anger that answers the sight of desecration. She wondered whether someone's diapers hung on a clothesline made of the motor's missing wires, whether its wheels had become a rope pulley over a communal well, whether its cylinder was now a pot containing geraniums on the windowsill of the sweetheart of the man with the whiskey bottle. There was a remnant of light on the hill, but a blue haze was moving in upon the valleys, and the red and gold of the leaves was spreading to the sky in strips of sunset. It was dark when they finished. She rose and leaned against the empty frame of the window for a touch of cool air on her forehead. The sky was dark blue. It could have set the whole country in motion and on fire. She looked down at the motor. She looked out at the country. She moaned suddenly, hit by a single long shudder, and dropped her head on her arm, standing pressed to the frame of the window. "What's the matter?" he asked. She did not answer. He looked out. Far below in the valley, in the gathering night, there trembled a few pale smears, which were the lights of tallow candles. Chapter 10 Wyatt's Torch.
"God have mercy on us, ma'am," said the clerk of the Hall of Records. "Nobody knows who owns that factory now. I guess nobody will ever know it."
The clerk sat at a desk in a ground-floor office where dust lay undisturbed on the files, and few visitors ever called. He looked at the shining automobile parked outside his window, in the muddy square that had once been the center of a prosperous county seat. He looked with a faint, wistful wonder at his two unknown visitors. "Why?" asked Dagny. He pointed helplessly at the mass of papers he had taken out of the files.
"The court will have to decide who owns it, which I don't think any court can do, if a court ever gets to it. I don't think it will."
"Why? What happened?"
"Well, it was sold out. The 20th Century, I mean. The 20th Century Motor Company. It was sold twice at the same time and to two different sets of owners. That was sort of a big scandal at the time, 2 years ago. And now it's just," he pointed, "just a bunch of paper lying around waiting for a court hearing. I don't see how any judge will be able to untangle any property rights out of it, or any right at all."
"Would you tell me, please, just what happened?"
"Well, the last legal owner of the factory was the People's Mortgage Company of Rome, Wisconsin. That's the town the other side of the factory, 30 miles north. That mortgage company was a sort of noisy outfit that did a lot of advertising about easy credit. Mark Yontz was the head of it. Nobody knew where he came from, and nobody knows where he's gone to now. But what